babble happily. We would look back at that girl child, her features growing more and more determined with each passing day, and say, "This is crazy. This is wrong. This is right. This is wrong." We would drive north and west and north and west until we reached an ocean and rocky shores and green everywhere and a big, big sky to hold the baby up to while she laughed. Before that, though, I kissed Ben softer, softer. His curls spilled through my fingers. We tasted like the whitest heat of a fire closest to the ground where most things burn. I said Ben Jr.'s name into his mouth, memorized the charred taste of it. Bad Priest. Father Mickey, Father Michael Patrick Minty, who went by Mickey to distance himself from the expectations of his mother, was having an affair with a girl named Rebecca. Rebecca was a perfume girl in a department store who still lived with her parents. She was not Catholic. Father Mickey's mother, Nora Minty, a devout Catholic, named her son Michael after the Archangel Michael, because she was convinced from the moment she laid eyes on her baby boy that he would be a warrior for the faith. He was named Patrick for his father, may he rest in peace, who left Nora when Mickey was 4, and died 3 months later from an excess of joy, Patrick Minty's friends would later say, because he died in his studio apartment, watching a baseball game with a 6-pack of beer in his lap. While his friends were told bedtime stories, Mickey Minty was nurtured with dark stories about the constant battle for salvation, and how David beat Goliath, and how Sodom and Gomorrah fell. Over and over, Nora would recite the book of Daniel, chapter 12, verse 1. "But at that time shall Michael rise up, the great prince who standeth for the children of thy people." He heard the verse so often that the words made him sick to his stomach. That is how, he later decided, the lining of his stomach began to give way to acid and ulcers. No one was more surprised than Michael Patrick Minty when he entered the seminary and then the priesthood. It was a simple life, he told himself. He didn't have to think that much. He would never have to support anyone. Mickey Minty wasn't incapable of handling responsibility, but given his mother's expectations, he simply didn't have the energy for anything more. There were his parishioners, but at the end of the day, he could lock himself in the rectory alone without having to worry about anyone but himself. There was comfort in that. And that comfort made the sacrifices of the priesthood something he could endure. Mickey Minty did not like to listen to strangers. He did not like to listen to anyone at all. The sounds of other voices, high-pitched and flighty, or low and timid, or any other variation, they all made him edgy and nauseated. There were days when he heard so many words detailing so many sins and sorrows and hopes and wants and needs that hot sprays of acid burned the back of his throat while he sat, hidden in the confessional, shifting his weight uncomfortably during particularly long excavations of human failing. Having to care, to soothe, to dispense was just too much. Worse yet was the way they looked to him for answers, eagerly listened to his counsel, believed, and dutifully carried out penance. What he hated was the way his parishioners had faith, faith that he would show them the way, and faith that he would fight for their faith, and faith that there was meaning in all of this, and faith that there was something greater than themselves. Mickey Minty had very little faith, so he lied to his parishioners. He lied so extravagantly that even though he was not a believer, he feared for his mortal soul. Rebecca had very little interest in church or faith, but she did have a great deal of interest in Mickey Minty, whom she met in the crowded waiting room of the county hospital, where she was waiting for a friend getting stitches. The friend, Ava, had put her fist through a glass door in a dramatic gesture meant to prevent her boyfriend from walking out on her. The gesture had failed spectacularly. Rebecca was waiting, and Mickey Minty was sitting next to her, wearing a light gray tracksuit, while he waited to hear news about an elderly parishioner who had been taken gravely ill. Mickey was looking at Rebecca and listening as she told him how she had just broken up with her boyfriend, Cesar, who had just gotten out of rehab and was more annoying than ever with his newfound sobriety and the fervor of 12 steps and the belief in a higher power. She was not sure there was a higher power, she added, leaning in close, resting a perfectly manicured hand on Mickey's knee as she crossed her legs. He tapped her knuckles with his fingers.
"We have something in common," he said.
Rebecca liked to talk to strangers, liked to pour her heart out, share the intimate and mundane details of her life with anyone who would listen. She was exactly the kind of parishioner who would get his stomach acids going. But Father Minty liked studying her lower lip, full and pouty, slick with gloss. Her mouth, he thought, was perfectly designed for things he shouldn't, but often did, contemplate. Her mouth was wide, and her tongue seemed especially long, coming to a perfect point he would enjoy nipping between his teeth. His faith was temporarily renewed. Mickey also didn't mind Rebecca's cleavage, ample and well displayed beneath the tightly stretched silk of a summer dress. He looked up at the fluorescent lights, shaking his head, then returned his attention to Rebecca's mouth. And not for nothing. She smelled sublime. Most of the time, he was around old people who smelled of ointments and cheap eau de toilette, so he was particularly appreciative of the effort Rebecca put into smelling so damn good. Despite her incessant chatter, Mickey knew instantly that he would be more than happy to bend his vows on her behalf. That night in the emergency room, Mickey Minty listened to Rebecca because she was wearing a short, tight dress and bright red lipstick, and her bra straps were showing. She was the kind of girl his mother warned him about when he was a teenager. She was the kind of girl who would have never paid him any mind. He now decided that the way she was dressed was irrefutable evidence that she was the kind of girl who needed saving. This is what he told himself as he told Rebecca that he was a priest. This is what he told himself when he invited her for a tour of his church, a tour she took the following weekend. On a Saturday, after Mickey Minty performed the O'Kelly wedding and wilting daisies were still hanging on the edges of the pews. The first time they fucked, they were in the church, and it was late, 2 in the morning. Moonlight shone through the stained glass, and Rebecca laughed and laughed because she liked the way her voice echoed beneath the vaulted ceilings. Rebecca wasn't his first indiscretion, but he was greedy with her. The experience was largely unmemorable for Rebecca, though she remembered that his fingers smelled like incense and his breath tasted like mint. And she remembered staring at 2 larger-than-life crucifixes, the one hanging behind the altar and the one draped around his neck, collaring him to his faithful service, and how they moved into and out of her sight with each of Mickey Minty's vigorous thrusts. A few nights later, Rebecca showed up at the rectory. 2 in the morning again, and she let herself in. She found Mickey Minty on the second floor, sitting on the edge of a narrow bed in a sparsely decorated room. He was holding a rosary, and he was whispering. His eyes were open, but he hardly looked up as she entered the room. Rebecca slipped out of her raincoat and sat next to Mickey. She rested a cold hand on the back of his neck, sliding her fingers up through his hair, short, neatly kept.
"You shouldn't have come here," Mickey said.
Rebecca quickly slipped out of her clothes and lay on her back, draping one arm over her head. The sheets were clean but rough, the mattress thin but firm. She pulled one of Mickey's hands between her thighs. He fingered the rosary beads with one hand, and Rebecca with the other. Later, when Mickey was sleeping, his rosary beads still clutched in his hand, Rebecca watched him for as long as she dared, then left before the rest of the church staff arrived for their morning duties. Rebecca thrived on hopeless relationships. Mickey was the most recent in a long line of inappropriate men who always left Rebecca intrigued but vaguely unsatisfied. What she liked about Mickey Minty was just how extremely inappropriate he was. She would never be able to introduce him to anyone she knew. He wouldn't make grand gestures or treat her kindly. He wasn't that kind of man, with or without the collar. And this heady combination of futility compelled Rebecca to fall madly, desperately in love with Mickey Minty. She gave very little thought to his spiritual obligations. They were minor details, and if there was guilt to be had on the subject, she left that to Mickey, who did, after all, deal in such things. Mickey had a flock to tend. Rebecca took to attending Mass, sitting in the front row and smiling demurely as he delivered stern sermons on adhering to Catholic doctrine while the world fell apart. He offered her the body, the blood of Christ, letting his fingers touch the moist tip of her tongue after placing the communion wafer between her slightly parted lips. After Mass, after the cookies and punch in the atrium, after he had done the home visits to the sick and shut-in, Mickey would take Rebecca out to dinner several towns over. They would sit in the back of the restaurant on the same side of the booth. Mickey would remove his collar, and Rebecca would rest her head against his shoulder, unzip his pants beneath the table, slide her hand into the crease, lightly stroking him, as the waiter took their order. She always ordered French onion soup and the roasted chicken. Mickey always ordered the porterhouse steak, rare, mushrooms on the side, and a glass of red wine. When they were done eating, they would sneak into the men's bathroom. They would go into the last stall. Mickey would turn Rebecca around so he didn't have to look at her. He would pull up her skirt, slide his pants down, and fuck her hard. He would grunt. He would pray under his breath. In his mind, he would call her filthy names. Then he would castigate himself for his indiscretion. Although he had little faith, he did have shame. When he was done, he would kiss Rebecca on her shoulder and inhale deeply, trying to identify the fragrance she had chosen for the day. Always something different, a benefit of her job. He would send her back to their table and then try to clean himself with thin paper towels and foamy dollops of industrial soap. On the nights when Rebecca knew she couldn't risk sneaking into the rectory, she would call Mickey on the phone. She would talk about her job and her family, and how Cesar was still hanging around trying to make amends. She would ask Mickey if that made him jealous and answer the question for herself. She would talk about her friends and the clubs where they partied, and how she wished Mickey could meet the people who mattered. Mickey wouldn't say much, though he would wince as his stomach churned, as he listened to Rebecca's sins and sorrows and hopes and wants and needs. He would endure her confessions as his penance. He prided himself on his ability to endure. He would listen and reach into the drawer in his nightstand, fumbling for a bottle of antacid tablets. He would chew four or five and wash the chalky crumbs down with a sip of water. He would endure. Then he would ask her what she was wearing, and he would stare at the small wooden crucifix on the wall, while Rebecca nurtured him with the filthy details of what she would do to him the next time they were together. Mickey visited his mother every Monday for dinner and a few hours of television, contemplation, her complaining, and inevitably prayer. After he started seeing Rebecca, Nora Minty became suspicious. She loved her son, but she was not blind to his failings, his weakness. "There's something different about you," she said one Monday evening, 8 months after Mickey and Rebecca had first consummated their affair. Nora said this as she carefully sliced a rare roast and lifted a dense, bloody piece of meat onto his plate. Mickey recoiled, gritted his teeth. He willed himself to smile kindly at his mother. He gripped his silverware until his fingers ached and carefully focused on the business of eating the slaughtered calf on the sacrificial altar of his plate. He listened as his mother railed against Satan and weakness and his eternal fight for the faith and the danger of temptation. Mickey willed the muscles in his throat to pull each carefully cut piece of meat into his stomach. He paused only to take sips of wine, cheap, red. He paused often. By the end of the meal, his stomach ached. His head was spinning, and his cheeks were flushed. His mother was yet another indignity he was forced to endure. "There's nothing different about me," he finally said, when they were settled in the family room eating pound cake as the television flickered silently. Nora sucked her teeth, reached for her Bible sitting on the end table. "We should pray," she said. Mickey shook his head. "All I do is pray. Let's just enjoy the evening." Nora's Bible was well worn and opened easily to her favorite passages. She held it open on her lap. "We'll pray. Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13. Mickey swallowed a dry lump of pound cake. "You'll have to refresh my memory." Nora sighed, then cleared her throat. "No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape, that you may be able to endure it."
"Endure, indeed. Thank you, Mother."
Nora reached over, gently patting Mickey's hand, then holding her Bible in the air. "This has all the answers." He slid lower in his chair, rubbed his temples, reached for the remote, and changed the channel. They sat in silence for the rest of the evening. Later, as he made his goodbyes, his mother shook her head, her lips pursed so tightly they had gone white. Then she grabbed hold of her son, held him tight, so tightly that he gasped,
"God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability,"
she whispered in his ear, her hot breath sending new sprays of acid into his throat. When he got back to the rectory, Mickey called Rebecca. His hands were sweaty and he could barely grip the receiver.
"Get over here,"
he said, not unkindly. Rebecca was at a bar a few blocks from the rectory when Mickey called. He didn't call often, leaving the responsibility of communication to her. She answered quickly, said nothing in response because she did not need to say anything. She was drinking with her girlfriends Angel and Sarah, who wanted to know, in explicit detail, who had called and where Rebecca was headed at that time of the night. She remained coy, quickly finished her beer, reapplied a fresh coat of lipstick, and hurried to the rectory, her heels echoing against the pavement. She found Mickey kneeling next to his bed, and she smiled when he looked up at her. Under different circumstances, in that moment, Rebecca would tell Mickey she loved him terribly. Instead, Rebecca stood next to her priest, dragging her long fingernails across the back of his neck the way he liked.
"I'm a bad man," Mickey said, holding her gaze.
Rebecca slid between Mickey and the bed. She pulled her skirt up, her panties down. She pulled Mickey's mouth toward her.
"I know," she replied.
Open marriage. We are having a heated debate about whether or not yogurt can expire when my husband suggests we stay together but see other people. He says open marriage intrigues him, that he couldn't be happier, but that he read this article online. I tell him yogurt cannot expire because it is filled with bacteria. I do not know if this is true, but I've seen commercials about yogurt that mention things like bacteria and the word probiotic, so I feel I have a sufficient command of the topic. I give him a look. I say, he's welcome to try to find other women to sleep with, but that I'm fine. And his face falls because he thinks I'm playing a trick on him. I'm not. He has no game, none at all. If I hadn't taken matters in hand, we would still be sitting on his couch in his bachelor apartment, his arm snaking around my shoulder after every yawn. I'm not worried. He's the kind of man who gets ideas but is largely unable to follow through on those ideas. He shoves his hands into his jeans. This is something he does often, wearing right through the pockets of most of his pants. He leans against the kitchen counter. He says he wants cultivating an open marriage to be something we do together. I politely decline once more. I say, I'm not inclined to open my half of the marriage, which only confuses him further because I'm quick-tempered and what he calls feisty, which only means I talk back to him and give him roadhead once in a while, and I'm the first woman who's ever done that in his limited experience. So it is still something of a novelty, still something that requires terminology. I take a bite of the yogurt that started our scientific debate. It expired more than 2 months ago, but appears edible. When I dip my spoon into the plastic container, the yogurt gives way easily. It tastes sour. My husband's face is red, and sweat beads on his upper lip. He asks if I would seriously be fine with him having no strings attached sex with another woman, and I say, yes, baby, of course. He tells me I'm amazing in bed, that it's not about being unsatisfied, and I say, yes, baby, of course. I rock his world on the regular, and we both know it. He can barely string three words together after we make love. He just lies there, trying to catch his breath, muttering, God damn, over and over. I say, good luck, and be safe. And don't you break my heart, baby, don't you break my heart. His eyes widen. I eat the entire container of yogurt, even going so far as to scrape the sides of the container until it is clean. I vocalize my appreciation for the expired yogurt and do a lot of elaborate spoon licking. I hold my husband's gaze the entire time. He was a virgin when we married. He looks away first. A pet. I saw a man eating alone in one of those hard plastic booths. He opened the paper wrapping for his burrito and carefully smoothed it into a perfect square. The whole scene broke my heart. He squeezed a small dollop of sauce in one corner from the orange foil packet, and before every bite of his burrito, he dipped the open end into the sauce. He ate slowly. I had to keep him company. When I entered the restaurant, the air was thick with the stink of cheap meat and steam and hand sanitizer. Sweat was on my neck and down my back and even between my thighs. I slid into the empty bench across from the man eating alone. He looked how you might expect, a messy graying beard, his head covered by a wool skull cap. His T-shirt was dirty and his jeans were torn. He was handsome. He looked up. I introduced myself because my mother once said, every conversation with a stranger should begin with your name. He stared at me, then wiped his mouth with his hand and stretched his arm across the table. The palm of his hand was calloused, and his knuckles were red with arthritis. He held my hand. He talked with his mouth full, introduced himself. His name had a lot of vowels, sounded made up. I asked if he'd like to come to my house for a proper meal. He shrugged. We walked the 3 miles back to my place. Sometimes cars honked at us. He walked on the outside, had real nice manners in his own way. We sat at my small kitchen table, didn't talk much, but we ate homemade leftovers and drank red wine. Later we retired to the living room and drank more wine and still didn't talk much. I held his hands in mine, held them for as long as he let me. He nodded toward my bathroom, asked if he could shower. I showed him where clean towels were, soap. He didn't take long, and when he was done, he stood in my hallway. I quickly finished my wine and went to him. I lay on my back and let him cover me. He said, "Thank you," and smiled and left. When I started grade school, my mother walked me on the first day. We stood together at the bottom of the large brick staircase leading into the school. She held my hand. She said, "Let me have a look at you," then licked her thumb and used it to tame my eyebrows. She straightened the hem of my jumper. She told me to stand still. I smelled her perfume and hoped the smell of her would stay with me all day. She said, "You make friends with the ugliest kids in your class, and you make friends with the loneliest kids in your class, the ones off by themselves. They will be the best friends you've ever had, and they'll make you feel better about yourself." With a pat on the head, she pushed me. Best features. Millie is fat and ugly, but she gives good head, so she rarely sleeps alone, which is not to say she's not lonely. Millie is not, in fact, ugly, but she might as well be. She has a pretty face, which is the same thing as ugly when a woman is fat. In the complex calculus between men and women, Millie understands that fat is always ugly, and that ugly and skinny makes a woman eminently more desirable than fat and any combination such as beautiful, charming, intelligent, or kind. Millie is all those things. She knows it doesn't matter. The truth of things makes Millie angry, but she is quiet about it, her anger. She keeps it to herself, knows it sits at the bottom of her chest, growing and growing. But there's not much she can do about it. She knows how difficult it is to change the world. She used to try to change the world, but she learned better. Jack is a troubled man. He has done time in county lockup, not hard time, but enough time where he has learned things about how to be the best kind of bad man. Jack is lonely and angry. The world is against him, and he's smart enough to know it. Jack is very self-aware. On their first date, which involved a very long drive from the country to the city, Jack told Millie about all his troubles. He talked about loneliness and bad friends and being stuck in a small town. He talked about not having any options and not knowing how to do anything with his dreams. Millie listened and listened and then asked, "What do you have to offer a woman?" Jack rolled down the window, lit a cigarette, inhaled deeply, sighed. "Not a damn thing," he said. Millie looked at him, appreciated the awkwardness and sincerity of his honesty. She took in his pretty gray eyes and thin red lips. She thought, "I might love this man more than he deserves." Jack can't drive because he doesn't like knowing the damage he could do behind the wheel of a car. He walks everywhere. His thighs are full of muscles that flex with every step. He is proud of his thighs. He knows they are one of his best features. He knows that having best features is the only thing he gets by on. Jack lives 9 miles from Millie's apartment. Every day at 4 in the afternoon, he starts walking to her place so he will arrive just as she is getting home from work. When Millie lets him in, he immediately takes a shower in her guest bathroom. She has told him he is welcome to use her bathroom, but he says, "I am a guest in your home," with real formality. He uses a fresh towel each time. This drives Millie crazy. She leaves them hanging on the towel rack. She doesn't care if they reek of mildew and mold. She hates doing a man's laundry. After he showers, Jack likes to walk around her apartment with his towel tied around his waist, like he belongs there. Sometimes he'll stop and flex and pose and preen. Millie pretends to find this charming. She hates the cliche of it, but Millie loves to cook, and she is very good at it. The first time she cooked for him, Jack said it made sense that a girl like her could cook so well. For a moment, Millie couldn't breathe as her anger flew out of her chest and into her mouth. She ran her tongue over it, hard and bitter, then swallowed it again. Millie makes everything from scratch, using natural ingredients, and Jack, accustomed to canned goods and frozen meals, takes real pleasure in eating Millie's food. He asks her detailed questions about how she has prepared her lasagna, or chicken cacciatore, or paella. He enjoys the sound of her voice, the warmth in it. Jack sits at the head of Millie's table, as if he belongs there, too. When he is eating, he is not a guest. He is a king. He lets her serve him and always salts his food before tasting it. Millie does not pretend to find this charming. When he does this, she rolls her eyes and comforts herself with the knowledge that his blood pressure cannot be good. They slept together the night they met, after several hours sitting feet apart on her couch, pretending to be absorbed in a popular romantic comedy they'd both seen several times. Millie tapped her fingers nervously against the arm of the leather couch, the sound echoing softly through the room. Her apartment has wood floors. Sound carries. Jack inched closer and closer as the night progressed, finally stretching his arms out and moving in to pull her toward him. He said, "I don't normally go for girls like you, but big girls try harder." And Millie couldn't help letting some of her anger trickle out. She said, "Don't do me any fucking favors." And Jack turned bright red. "I meant that as a compliment," he stammered. Millie decided she hated him, and that turned her on, so she said, "Let's get on with it then." In her bedroom, Millie quickly undressed and slid beneath the sheets, waiting. Her stomach hurt. It always did the first time she slept with a man. She hated knowing how he would look at her body, and she hated what he would think, but she knew that girls like her had little choice but to put out. So that's what she did. She put out whether she wanted to or not. She barely remembered what it felt like to truly want a man. She rarely slept alone. Jack took his time undressing as he took in the spare decor. Millie saw little point in spending much time making a room pretty if most of her time in that room was spent with her eyes closed. "I like this," he said. "I don't care," Millie replied. He was a hairy man, his body covered in a thick mat of dark hair. Later, when he fell asleep as he lay on top of her, the whorls of hair on his chest would tickle her uncomfortably, and she would say nothing. She would say nothing, but her anger, just a bit of it, would trickle from between her lips, down her neck, resting at the base of her throat. It burned. Millie had ample breasts, and they were soft and always smelled good. She knew they were her best feature, and Jack enjoyed them thoroughly. He couldn't stop talking about their dimensions as he squeezed and licked and nibbled and sucked.
"I'm going to come all over your tits," he said.
Millie lay beneath him, one arm over her head, and patted his shoulder. Men were all the same. She hated knowing that. When he had drawn enough amusement from her décolletage, Jack wasted no more time. He forced her thighs apart with his and started fucking her. He stared at the spot on the wall just above her headboard, and then he stared into her eyes, which made her uncomfortable. So Millie put on a good show, bouncing in rhythm enthusiastically, making the appropriate noises, feigning ecstasy. She told Jack how big he felt inside her and took the Lord's name in vain and demonstrated her flexibility by resting her calves against his narrow shoulders. Jack moaned loudly, made comments about how fucking good she felt, how tight. He told her she was a good girl. He said her pussy felt amazing. She didn't care if he was telling the truth. Millie felt nothing, but she was very good at making men think otherwise. Sometimes, she nearly convinced herself.
Bone density. Winter is more a state of being than a season in this place. It takes hold for 6 or 7 dark, cruel months. The cold becomes familiar. There is a silence when it snows. Tonight, we sit together but alone with our work. We can see outside, to the street, where now and again a car creeps through inches of the white stuff. Its sounds muffled by a fresh blanket of powder. The fire is waning, but we are too lazy, not intrepid enough to brave the elements and gather more wood from the shed in the back. We sit, not speaking to each other, filling the quiet around us. Every hour or so, I slide my feet into wool slippers, pull my sweater around me and smoke a cigarette by the back patio door, open only an inch or two. Snow has been falling for several hours, and the absence of sound as fresh flakes fall to the ground is seductive. I feel slight pangs of guilt as I ash my cigarette, the dark flakes damaging the winter portrait, and I can hear his heavy sighs. He disapproves. He worries because he reads about the hazards of smoking and is particularly concerned that smoking decreases bone density. He likes me the way I am. Doesn't want to see me become less of a woman, he says. Our relationship is like this. David travels 3 or 4 days out of every week of every month of every year. He's a professor of mechanical and biomedical engineering at the local university. He is somewhat renowned in his field. This is what I'm told by his adoring colleagues and students at boring cocktail parties, where I play the part of devoted wife. They always marvel at what it must be like to be married to the great Dr. David Foster III. They imagine, I think, that our nights are filled with romantic whisperings about fluid dynamics and heat transfer or the power of biomechanical joints. They forget that I am a writer and maintain only a cursory understanding of and interest in David's work, just enough to assure him that my love is true. In exchange, he maintains the same level of understanding about my writing and carefully pores over any story I place before him. He is deliberate in how he reads my work. He leans forward, slides his glasses up his nose and clears his throat, as if that might somehow help him clear his mind and gain greater insight into my words. Our relationship is like this. A terrible cliché.
He is that professor who has torrid but discreet affairs with research assistants and students and strangers he meets in hotel bars. He knows I know. I know he knows I know. It's an interesting equation. But we pretend that we're both faithful and true. The lie suits us, and I refuse to play the part of the dissatisfied, jealous wife. I'm not dissatisfied. I know who I married, and I have secrets of my own. There's a poet, Bennett, who lives in a cabin on the other side of town. He has no telephone, lives nearly off the grid. He is completely different from David. Dark, unhappy, brooding. He is enamored with the idea of himself as a tortured poet in search of his own Walden Pond. Bennett's self-involvement is one of his most attractive qualities. Bennett is not romantic, and we don't delude ourselves about the state of our affair. He is, however, intense and always leaves me sore in uncomfortable places. When David is out of town, and only when David is out of town, I sneak away to Bennett's place. The cabin is small, spare, but clean. It is a home. He heats it with an antique wood-burning stove. He doesn't want any distractions when he's writing, he tells me. So he doesn't bother with most modern conveniences, save for a stereo to play music. His focus can be so singular it frightens me. When he gets an idea in his head, nothing else matters. I don't matter. That turns me on, too. Sometimes I watch him, hunched over a small wooden desk, writing furiously with a lead pencil, and I know he has forgotten that I'm on his bed, naked, the flat sheet bunched under my armpits. There is little ceremony between us. Bennett takes me into his arms, or shoves me against the wall, knocking a picture loose, the instant I open his door and call his name. He's like a teenager, groping at me awkwardly, pulling my clothes off, sliding his fingers between my thighs. "You're wet," he'll grunt, as if he's surprised, each time that he continues to excite me. We fuck on his narrow twin bed. The coarse sheets make my skin raw. I grip the headboard with one hand and hold the wall with the other, my eyes closed. Bennett buries his head in my shoulder. Eye contact bothers him. He never wants to reveal too much of himself. I love his body and enjoy marking him with my fingernails, leaving the skin of his back angry and broken. His arms are strong, deeply tanned even in the dead of winter, and tightly woven with sinewy muscles from years of chopping wood and climbing rocks. His thighs are thick from snowshoeing and hiking. He has the look of a man who uses his body more than he uses his mind. It is a contradiction. Looks are deceiving. With my legs wrapped around Bennett's waist, my body filled, my lover is longer than my husband. I think of David, who is almost delicate in comparison. My husband is soft, where Bennett is rough. Handsome, where Bennett is not. After he comes, in a loud, ugly display that always scares me the way I like, my lover and I lie next to each other smoking. We use a saucer as an ashtray, leaving it balancing precariously between us. Bennett is not remotely concerned with the density of my bones. He never asks me why I don't come. That I return time and again seems to be enough for him, as it is for me. I like the gnawing dissatisfaction I carry home. I will rest my head on Bennett's chest and listen to him talk about his poetry. Sometimes he reads to me, or we listen to old bluegrass records. I tell him what's going on in the world beyond the walls of his cabin. I allow myself to drown in the way he smells, natural and sweaty, and his contradictions. When he falls asleep, I tuck a quilt around him, wrap myself in the necessary layers to brave the outdoors, and I leave. He never asks when I'll be back. He knows he will see me again, or he doesn't care, which also turns me on. Tonight, David is home and Bennett is wherever he is. After a last cigarette, I return to the family room and smile at David, his face shadowed by the dim glow of his laptop monitor. I snap the computer shut and sit on his lap, tracing his ear with my finger. "It's time for bed," I say. He kisses the left corner of my mouth, then slides his hands, smooth like alabaster, save for a small callus where he holds his pen, beneath my shirt. I shiver, pulling his hands upward to my breasts. I remove his glasses, kiss his forehead, slide my lips along the length of his nose. And then we're kissing, our breath warm with tobacco, coffee, hot pepper from dinner. After 11 years, David knows my body well. While we make love, I think of Bennett. With David, I allow myself to come extravagantly. I spend our days apart, imagining what kind of lover David must be like with his other women. Is he as insatiable with them as he is with me? I imagine shiny, nubile girls, their bodies shaved elaborately, breasts round high, perky, calf muscles taut. They have their parts to play in the cliché. I imagine them sitting coyly in his cluttered office, calling him doctor, perched on the edge of his desk. I imagine them playing the part of ingenue, all plaid skirts, white shirts, thighs spread wide, revealing pristine white panties, moist all the way to the edges. It turns me on to think of him in these tarts, tangled in rough impersonal hotel sheets, making a mess of themselves and a mess of our marriage. I think of these girls when he's fucking me and telling me that I'm a hot lay and his hair is damp, clinging to the edges of his face, and in his eyes, I can see that he does love me. I think of them when he's telling me how special I am to him. I start to wonder if perhaps, for him, the word has a different definition. In the morning, we are in bed, David's heavy arm draped across my body. He is very possessive when he sleeps. Likes to keep me close, he tells me. It is cold, and from our bedroom window, I can see that it is still snowing. Before winter's end, more than 350 inches will fall. I extract myself from his embrace and go to the kitchen to start coffee. When I return, he is sitting up, channel surfing, looking more like a young man than someone in his late 30s. His chest bare, is covered in goosebumps. Our relationship is like this. I need these moments to remember why I love him, even when I hate him. David grins at me, takes the proffered coffee. He nods toward the window. "We should go for a walk," he says. I shrug. I am not one for the outdoors, but I can make these small sacrifices. Outside, the trees are bare and skeletal. He holds my hand, and I follow in the large footsteps he makes with his boots. "I want to show you something," he says. We head into the thicket of trees behind our home, and after 15 minutes come upon a small creek, the water still inexplicably running over frozen stones. He wipes a few snowflakes from my scarf, tightens my jacket around me. "Don't you love this place?" I lean against a thick tree trunk and bite my lower lip. David pulls his camera from his coat pocket. "Don't move," he says. I glare into the camera. He knows I hate having my picture taken, and yet he persists. This is what our relationship is like. the not really knowing one another. He makes a silly face, and I finally crack a smile. David furiously presses the shutter release to capture the moment. His earnestness makes me smile wider, and soon I am playing it up for the camera. He pauses, looks at me carefully. Then he closes the distance between us, and he is pressing me against the tree, studying my face carefully. I clasp my hand around his neck, trying to keep a small separation between us. I look away. We ignore the camera as it drops into a soft pile of snow. The branches above me are beautiful, encased in snow and ice. Later, I am in our bathroom, drying my hair. David stands behind me, wrapping his arms around my waist. We watch each other in the mirror.
I have to go out of town tomorrow, he says. It's a last-minute thing. I'm taking the place of a guy in my department at a very important conference. Can't be avoided.
I roll my eyes at David in the mirror and throw the hairdryer onto the bathroom counter. It clatters loudly and I bite my lower lip. I don't want David to think he gets under my skin. Very important. David kisses my right shoulder. You know how it is. I smile tightly. The day after David leaves, I will pay Bennett a visit. I will bring him a new record I found at the Salvation Army. I will miss my husband. The winters here are long, but they are even longer when you spend them alone. There's Bennett, but I know where I stand with him. Such clarity is uncomfortable. After a big snowfall, the white flakes turn to gray sludge, then dark with sand and salt. A fresh layer of ice covers the streets and sidewalks. I long to wear shoes instead of the clunky boots necessary to navigate the outdoors. David has gone for 8 days on his very important business. I fill the days with my work, which takes a darker turn. It is hard to write about happy things when you can never escape the kind of cold that sinks into your bones and stays there. I am in Siberia, I decide. I am comforted by thoughts of exile, cold solace, meditation, and inspiration born of emotional deprivation. It is all very dramatic. My evenings are filled with dinner and friends, bad television movies, and planning dream vacations in sunnier climes. David dutifully calls me 3 times a day, as regular as 3 square meals. Our conversations are brief during the day, longer at night. He loves to hear me come, he tells me. I love to give him a show. I tell him all the dirty things I am doing to myself in excruciating detail. He makes me beg over the phone, and I can hear his satisfaction when I do. He revels in the knowledge that no matter the distance, he has a hold over me. The specificity of these conversations and the ways I am willing to debase myself are 2 of the reasons he enjoys being married to a writer. He often tells me, I have a knack for details. I wonder if he's alone during these calls, or if his hand is running through a lover's hair as he listens to his wife playing the part of his whore. A part of me hopes he isn't, because sometimes I am not. When David returns, he is full of stories about drunken engineers in swanky bars in downtown Philadelphia and the inferior intellects of the people in his field. He beats his chest. I am a god among men, he says, winking. But more than anything, I missed you. Of course you did, I reply. For the next several weeks, I will tease him mercilessly and remind him that he is a god among men. He will find this endearing, until he doesn't. When I unpack David's suitcase,
I create neat piles of clothes that can be put away, laundered, or sent to the dry cleaner. I organize his toiletries, making sure he has enough toothpaste, lotion, shaving cream for the next occasion when he must conduct very important business. The routine relaxes me, reminds me of my part-time role as wife. I search the pockets for matchbooks, coins, receipts, design ideas on cocktail napkins. Once I found a joint, and before bed we smoked in the shed in the backyard, giggling like teenagers until we singed our fingers on the roach. This time, I find a Polaroid image of David posing with a young brunette, attractive in her own way. She is smiling. He is not. She is hugging him from the side, looking at him the way I imagine all his young lovers look at him, adoringly, desperately. They don't know the man I married, how betrayal comes so easily to him, so they can afford to look at him like that. David looks like he's trying to slide out of this girl's embrace. It's a sad little scene. There is a phone number written across the bottom of the picture in red lipstick. I leave the Polaroid on his side of the bathroom, perched against the toothbrush holder. This isn't the first time I've found an artifact of his infidelity. It won't be the last. I leave the tokens for him to find, because he has left them for me to find. We play games because we can, and we like it. Most days, these games keep us together somehow. Later tonight, he will tell me it's time for bed. We'll slide naked between our sheets. He'll lie on top of me, and I will relax, enjoy how my chest constricts beneath the weight of his body like I'm suffocating. I'll drown in a scent of cologne and his hair products and body wash. We'll make love like we haven't shared our bodies with anyone else, like we are still the people we once promised to be. After I've finished putting his things in order, and I've cooked his dinner and we've made the small talk married people who know each other too well make, we sit in our family room, on our couch, in our familiar positions between laptops and secrets and lovers and the silence of the snow that continues to fall. The old radiators creak as they struggle to cough hot air into the room. "Are you cold?" David asks with a shy smile. I nod, and he pulls me close, wrapping his arms around me. His body feels narrow, almost frail against mine, as if his bones have lost some of their density. I return his embrace. I realize I'm holding less of a man than he once was. I wonder how much stamina we have left for the games we play. And then I stand in the back doorway for a smoke, thinking about Bennett. Rough and merciless, necessary. I accept that I am, perhaps, less of a woman.
I am a knife. My husband is a hunter. I am a knife. Last deer season, he took me on a hunt with him. At 4 in the morning, he shook me awake. He made love to me. He always fucks me before the hunt. There is a quality to his efforts that is different. Better. He takes me. He uses me. He marks me. I allow him to. When he finished, he told me not to shower. As we dressed, I could still feel him inside me, sticking to my thighs. It was cold outside. In the cab of his truck, I leaned against his arm, my eyes closed. He drank coffee from a thermos that used to belong to his father, who is dead from black lung. His beard would smell like coffee for the rest of the day. We spent hours in the deer blind, doused in deer piss, waiting. I grew bored, but stayed silent. I am a knife,
Several does passed before us, but my husband held one finger to his